You're listening to The God Journey, a place where people thinking outside the box of organized religion can share thoughts and conversation along the journey. Here are your hosts and fellow travelers, Wayne Jacobson and Brad Cummings.
I'm Brad Cummings.
And I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And here we are at our anniversary show. We've been doing this for how long?
This has been a year now. Can you believe it?
I can.
On second thought, I can too.
We've been having a lot of fun, but no, it kind of stuck up to me that we've actually been doing this for a year. We've got a little following of listeners that are running away on the forum. There's quite a bunch of discussion going on.
There's a whole lot going on there, and some people are getting a little long-winded, I got to tell you.
Some are a little longer than I have time to scan, but if you wade through it, man, there's some great stuff that is being shared in some wonderful life of its own that's taking shape.
Yeah, it's great fun. I enjoy hitting the forum and seeing where people are talking about and what's going on in Canada. I keep an eye on those Canadians. they give me a bit of a scare, but I'm going there actually in
Canada?
The end of May. I'm going actually not far from Detroit, just crossing the river into Canada from Detroit. Planning on being there real quick.
Want to get some cheap pharmacy meds or what? What are you doing?
By the time you had the airfare on, you know, it's really not cheap meds. No.
Okay.
Hanging out with a group there that has been through their messianic phase.
Oh, okay.
And finding out that wasn't the religion that they were looking for either, or it was the religion they were not looking for. So anyway, I'm going to go help them kind of sort through some relational issues, see what God does.
Oh, that's great. Hey, we had some wonderful feedback on the relational leadership show, and I just got Guido, way to go, Guido. He's from Germany, had a phenomenal way to just kind of summarize stuff. He said,
the one on the leadership, yeah.
Yeah, he said, last year I remembered this term and I was thinking about it from Matthew 20, verses 20 to 28, and Matthew 20. He said, I saw that in my innermost, my nature should be like a servant. And he said, it's not servant leadership, but leading servanthood. That's just a phenomenal little play on the words there, because I do think the emphasis is fantastic.
Doesn't that turn it around? I heard a missionary from Russia say one time, he said, I was talking about servant leadership with this group of pastors, and one of the pastors volunteered and said, you know what I really hate about servant leadership? I mean, so he said, I could really get into this servant leadership except for the serving part. You know, you'll find honesty is refreshing.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah. And he said, it's not leaders who serve as in feeding the lambs, but servants who bring, as in lead people closer to Jesus. And of all the discussion on the leadership stuff, man, Guido, thank you. You said it to an absolute point.
Gold star. That's wonderful. We also heard from Reese from Australia, and he wrote us about a podcast a while back called Suffering in the Journey. And it just came at a real propitious moment in his own life. He said, at the beginning of this year, at the tender age of 39, I was diagnosed with a small tumor on my right kidney. This was a shock to the system. Couldn't tell my family right away as they were dealing with the unexpected death of my grandmother. So I had to keep a secret for a while. It was frightening time. That is, after the shock wore off. But during this time, the podcast by you and Brad about suffering and the journey really helped me get my eyes away from the circumstances and onto Father. And that is exactly what I needed right then. Then he says that he had a successful operation. The kidney's been the tumor's been removed, and they were able to preserve a significant amount of his kidney. And he's kind of been pronounced healed, but he says, thanks for doing podcasts on tough subjects like pain and suffering. As depressing as these subjects are, I've been lied to my whole life about suffering and had no idea how to handle it when it came my way, but that's changing now.
Oh, well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so we're going to take actually all the first year shows. We're going to put them on a CD for those that are tired of tracking them all down on computer. And we're going to make that available probably the next couple of weeks. So,
that'll be fantastic.
Yeah, it'll be fun to have it out.
Wow, so we're starting off a second year.
A second year, and we've got a special guest with us today.
Who's here with us?
Special to me, anyway. I want to introduce you. It's my colleague on the Jake Colson book. If some of you don't know, the last 5 years, he and I have been working on a book together called So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore.
And the title reads, it's been hard to like walk around in public. It seems to say, don't go to church anymore.
Yeah. Have you been hit yet?
A couple times.
Okay, well.
I was in the DMV line and some lady's looking at me like, what's that?
It's those little old church ladies with umbrellas that you want to watch out for.
Run.
Fortunately, in California, umbrellas are not something we carry around a lot. Anyway, we published that under Jake Colson as a pen name. And the other side of that, I'm the Jake part of that. And the Cole part of that is Dave Coleman, a longtime friend from Visalia, California. Dave, welcome to The God Journey.
Hey, thanks, guys. It's a privilege to be here and share some time with you.
I've been getting the inside track of some of the historical realities behind Wade, and we've been laughing quite a bit.
We promise not to talk about them on air.
Dave, I want to thank you for outing Wayne and telling some of the truth about him.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Where should I start?
No, you're done. That's the point. Thanks for joining us today, Dave.
Yeah. I'd be curious, where did the two of you first meet? I mean, how did the friendship strike up?
Well, basically, I've known Wayne for, I would say, 22 years, 7 months, 38 days.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. You lie.
Is this coming to an end at some point? You sound like a countdown there.
No, we go back really over 20 years when we were both pastoring church, not together, we each had our own congregation up in Visalia, California. And we just kind of got acquainted and went through our various, which you've talked about before, our various outings of the ministry, if you will.
That's what we meant by outing. Suddenly I'm relieved.
And we kept in touch all of these years, and this is basically the only project that we've worked on. And how we came to write about this, I'm not really sure. Do you remember, Wayne?
I'm not sure we started the project. I don't think it's the first thing we did. I'm not sure I remember starting this. I remember when I first met Dave and his wife, Donna, and they had three kids and had recently lost one in a tragic accident. And
oh, wow.
So we got to know them just a little bit. And in fact, I had Dave teach a marriage class with me, and we kind of teamed up on that. And I love the stuff that Dave taught. I love what he brought to the table for some of our couples. And he certainly had much more experience than some of us did in terms of years of marriage. But
you say he's older?
Yeah, he's older. That's right. I'm trying to make that point. The picture on the podcast, the picture on the website will convince people of that. Anyway, I really enjoyed what he was doing, and I enjoyed the things God had put in his heart about relationships and relational life in God. And some of those things, and some of the language that's in John's mouth in this book, if you haven't read the Jake book, there's kind of a character in there that's John. He may or may not be the apostle from the first century, still hanging out with the church of the 21st. But a lot of things in John's mouth, Dave said to me at various times, that you know, some of those took a little while to weasel their way into my life and make some changes. But Dave has been one of those John people in my life that's helped me kind of learn to live this journey a bit more authentically than I was when we first met.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how did the two of you come up with the idea to collaborate on this book? Where'd the idea come from? Where, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we just were, I mean, some of the themes of this book are themes that we've shared in our relationship and shared with our challenge with raising children and all those kinds of things. And one day we got talking about, let's write a book about that. You know, freeing people from this sense of religious obligation and helping them learn to live what it means to live the life of Christ. And so we talked, we had a number of incarnations. Probably we called the Chocolate Church at one point, and we were trying to write a nonfiction book, but couldn't interest publishers in it. And then one day this little idea of writing a fictional story and bringing this John character up against a guy named Jake, it just hit us. It seemed right. And we started this journey. We thought it would take us a year. Unfortunately, it took us 4 to finish it on the website. So we really tortured some of our listeners who had to wait 4 months between new chapters appearing, which was a bit of a nightmare. And during that time, Dave had a little bit of a struggle with cancer, too. So that was a big part of that that helped delay us some, I think.
Well, you guys initially put this out on the web, and then you finally printed it in book form that's available for folks.
Just came out, yeah, a few weeks ago.
And what are you hoping is going to happen with the book?
Basically, just to help people. And in working with people, the last 10 years before I retired here recently, I was working as a hospice chaplain and ran into a lot of people who, you know, I knew that when I would go see them for the first time, the obvious question was going to be, why did this happen to me?
Right.
Why is God punishing me? What did I do wrong? Even before that time, this question really bothered me, because we always looked at the whole concept of Christianity as some sort of a system of ethics, if you will, where if you do the right thing, good things will happen. If you do the wrong thing, bad things will happen. And so you would meet these dear people who had maybe a week or a month or maybe a few weeks to live at the most. And here you are faced with a problem that they have struggled with all of their lives, and now it comes to, you know, the point where, hey, really, can you answer this for me? And I think basically that was one of the questions that I wanted to see answered in this book, so that people will be able to say, hey, you know, there is something going on here, and God is involved in all of this. And that basically was my desire, just to help people find some of the deep answers of life and to really work it through in their relationship with God.
That's fantastic. As someone who's read the book, I just loved it. It's a great, I think, narrative tool that you tell a great story of people kind of going on a journey. And there's a lot of different entry points for people in terms of just great questions that get asked. But like every like two or three pages, you guys throw out like a religious hand grenade that kind of blows up someone's former way of thinking. You do it very kindly. I mean, I thought it was a great way to do that. But man, it's like you can hear the sacred cows tipping left and right as you go through this thing.
Oh, now you know my relationship with Dave has been like that. Every few weeks he tosses one of those grenades.
Cows.
every now and then he tosses one of those grenades into my life, and I'd be going, "Oh no, not again!" I remember when he said to me. Which we put this directly in John's mouth. Wayne, when are you going to get over the mistaken notion that Christianity is about ethics? And I...
That's just a mind bender right there. You're going, it's not?
I had no idea how to even answer him. I went, what, he's saying it's not? Are you on drugs? Are you confused? Are you got dementia? What? That's all I've ever known. Be good. God will be good to you. I think what we kind of take Jake through is he starts like most of us who've been schooled in religion. And that is... God is someone to work. You learn how to work God through Christianity, endear him to you, and get him to fulfill things in your life. And I think where Jake goes in this journey is he learns that God is someone not to work at all, but he's someone to love and live in and let God shape and change his life. And that's I think Dave has put that stuff into my life probably more than anyone else.
That's fantastic. The mistaken notion of Christianity is not about ethics. Help us out a little bit for those who are, you know, trying to crack our heads and get our minds around this. What is it about?
Well, it's Dave's hand grenade. Let him tell you.
Well, let's take the theological word, sin. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, to most people, to most Christians, they would think of sin as knocking off the Wells Fargo stage when it rumbles in the town, like doing bad stuff.
Back to Westerns again.
Don't go there, Dave.
And, so consequently, now where does that concept come from? I was talking with one of our hospice nurses not too long ago, and we were in a discussion as to what does she do as a nurse and what do I do as a chaplain. And we got talking about this. I said, well, basically, I have to correct a lot of theology that all of us have learned on our little painted chairs in Sunday school. And, you know, talking about, you know, a good Christian boy doesn't smoke or chew or run around with girls who do. And this whole thing has a way of sticking with us as we grow up. And I said, let's really understand what we're talking about. When the Bible discusses sin, it's not talking about doing bad stuff or doing good stuff. It's talking about the whole concept of manipulation. Sin is control. And our desire to control God, to control others so that we will basically be comfortable. And she looked at me and she jumped out of her chair and she says, that's it. She says, and I've never heard that. She said,
I've never heard that.
Yeah. She said, if there's anything in my life that has caused me problems, it's my attempt to control my husband, to control my kids, yep. And just to control everything about it. But basically, that is what the church teaches, that, you know, we're controlled by parents, we're controlled by pastors, by Sunday school teachers. It's all the same thing. And finally, you just get so tired of it. It's not a new deal. I remember years ago reading a survey that was taken by a women's magazine, Good Housekeeping, where they sent out a questionnaire to 500 people who deal in marriage counseling, pastors, priests, therapists, and the whole thing, and they ask, what is the one reason, what's the one cause for divorce in this country? And they came back unanimously, control.
Wow.
People get tired of being controlled and controlling others. It's not about money, sex, or all the other stuff. It's about this whole basic nature of wanting to be like God, to control God. And God has to move and manipulate for us. When he doesn't, we get mad. It's my personal feeling that 90% of the people who go to church on Sunday morning do so because they're afraid of what might happen if they don't go. No, really. So there you go.
Wow, that's a great motivation.
Yeah, so right there is the control issue. God, I've been to church for the last upteen Sundays. Now you got to do something for me.
Why do you think we're so susceptible? I mean, this is for both of you guys, but why do you think we're so susceptible to, one, the desire to perhaps want to control, or the whole dynamic of being controlled by others? I mean, what's behind that? Dave's pointing at me.
Yeah, I like that.
That's awesome.
It's only fair. I've done it a couple times myself already, so he's just getting me back, I think. The nature to control, I love it. It's just the nature of sin. It's somehow I want to define my own happiness. I want to define what makes me happy, and to do that, I've got to manipulate God and everybody around me to do that. So, but I like to think of control, because here's the fallacy of religion, because I think religion is all about control, but the fallacy of religion is only about the illusion of control, because in fact, we don't have control of our lives. And the more we try to force people to do things the way we want it, the more we try to force circumstances into our mold, they just don't go there very naturally. I mean, maybe for a time we'll get away with that, but eventually it comes crashing down. Dave, one of the stories you told me recently, which somebody you're visiting with in hospice that was been a religious woman all her life and had cancer, was dying, was depressed. And I don't remember the story, but you said that one of her daughters said, hey, ask her about tithing, because that seems to be a real part of her depression, and we don't know what it is. Do you remember the story? Could you?
Oh, very well. Dear little old lady in her 80s, I called on her, and sometimes, you know, with hospice, we use pain medication, palliative medicine, it's called. And we had given her so much that, actually it would have killed a horse, but we couldn't control her pain. Because it was more than physical pain, it was what we can call spiritual pain. And she was being taken care of by her daughter, as Wayne said. And so I asked the daughter, I said, why is she lying there just, you know, in such a desperate need? I said, I can't get through to her. And she said, I can't either. And I said, and it sounds like she's saying the word tithe. And she said, yeah, she's saying it over and over again. And I said, well, can you tell me what that's about? And she said, well, when we were young, she said, her dad went off to war in the Second World War, and he was one of the early ones killed. And my mother took care of us, and she did all kinds of things, and taking in, you know, washing and so forth. And she said, I know there were times when she didn't even eat in order for us to have food. And we attended a church who talked not only about tithing, and they used it as a whip. And in those days, she said, we had no money. She couldn't pay her tithe. And now she feels that God is punishing her.
Oh.
And she's just lying there in spiritual pain because of this whole burden that was placed upon her, that she failed God, and God will now not only punishing her with this, but he's going to condemn her for the rest of her life. And this is the thing that
And in some sick way, when you relayed to me the first time, it was almost a relief on her heart that she had finally figured out why she had gotten this cancer. I mean, on the one hand, you know, the tragedy of, gosh, what now rejected by God, or, you know, whatever, being punished by him. But there was almost a relief, because before it was, I can't figure out why. I mean, after I've been doing all these right things for so long and raising my daughters and all this, why would I get cancer? And one of the things that Dave has said to me a lot about as chaplaincy work with hospice is that when people lose control of their lives, and death is the ultimate loss of control, particularly for religious people, people who have learned that God is someone you can control, someone to work, that the most distressing thing is now coming at sickness or dying or physical loss of abilities, is especially traumatic, because now they're really facing this breakdown of the illusion. You were not in control of your life. You never were in control of your life. But then they feel like it's a personal failure, or that now God's failing them, or that God's punishing them. And some ways they're a bit relieved that they've sorted it out. But gosh, what a horrible reality that is for people. What do you say to folks like that, Dave? What did you say to her to help her see differently?
You have to deal with the concept of loss. I think the greatest thing that can happen to any of us is to lose things. You know, we say he who has the most toys at the end wins. No, it's he who loses everything wins. Because that's what Jesus said.
It is what Jesus said.
He who loses his life for my sake, you know, shall gain it. And what happened to me, to mature as a Christian means loss, giving up all of these comfort things, all of these things that we were taught were so important to us, you know, it's really been, you know, a blessing to me. You mentioned going through cancer, and I did, and I came to the point where it was one night in the hospital, I almost knew for sure I was dying, and that was a loss you have to deal with, and it was just probably the best experience of my entire life to realize that, hey, this is ultimately in God's hands, and that I don't have to fight, I don't have to do anything like this, and God is involved in this, and whatever happens, it's up to him. And that, you know, but people don't see that when it's lost. You know, oh, I've lost this, and we go around, and I got to get the victory. I got to pray it in. I got to, you know, and so somebody says, well, you give me $100 seed money, and God will give you $10,000. And
oh, there goes another sacred cow.
And we go through all of these, you know, manipulations is really what they are, trying to save our own lives. It just doesn't work that way.
See, I think that's such an interesting concept that you guys are really kind of tossing around, because most people that I would deem are controlling, if you tried to point it out to them, they deny it to your face. They don't see that that's what they're doing. And what I hear from you is a lot of people's effort, even in their sort of their good, well-behaved Christian performance, that really is sort of an attempt to manipulate God on some sort of justice means, like he owes me. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then the dynamics and the way they relate to a lot of other people's, it's usually because out of a fear of somehow not perhaps being provided for, that they then try to manipulate the others around them. I mean, you toss out another hand grenade in this book. It says church as we know it is sort of a mutual accommodation of self-need. And I just kind of went, oh, wow. Another mind bender there. Hey, talk about that a little more. What are you talking about?
Well, I think our arrangement of relationships in a highly attempt to control environment is, and I think it's why the average church in America, the average congregation splits every 6.7 years, because our religious enterprises are healthy if it really is about control. And I think you're right, but I think most people don't see it. Religion is taught to us in such a way, it's like fish swimming in an aquarium. You don't see the control because you've been in it all your life. You really don't step until you step back. Something happens, some disillusioning moment of some great tragedy, or, you know, somebody drops a hand grenade in your life that begins to shift the way that you think. But this mutual accommodation of self-need means, you know, if we get together and I have a need to teach and you have a need to be taught and I have a need to lead worship and you have a need to be led in worship, and we have this balance of our mutual accommodation of self-need, as long as we do that, we're going to be a happy little fellowship together. But then the day comes when not everybody's self-need is being fulfilled, and then people are challenged. Think somebody's pushed for control. Board takes over and causes something to happen they want to happen. People get forced out. And it's that then if it finds another equilibrium, then it goes on for a few more years. Everything's good and dandy. And then something else shocks it again. I think people do the same thing in marriage. We talk about falling in love, the mutual accommodation of self-need. As long as you give me what I want and I give you enough of what you want, we get together in marriage. When that ceases to happen, when you cease to be a benefit to me in the way I want to be benefited, then people talk about falling out of love. And it really is nothing more than the same thing. It's the mutual accommodation of self-need, trying to align up my life around me so that people will make me happy. And, yeah, I worked all that as a religious guy. And I you know, you do it thinking this is what God wants us to do. I benefit people when I manipulate them to make me happy. That's how distorted that becomes.
Wow.
And when God pulls the mask off of that, and you look back at all the ways, I mean, and not just in religious kinds of constructs, but
you're just talking about life.
Even my marriage with children, with, you know, ways that I manipulated them because I wanted to be happy. And I thought my happiness was what God wanted above all else. You can't be a believer.
Isn't that why he died? Yeah. For my happiness?
Well, that's the point we're making. I don't think so.
It sounds like selfishness is at the core.
Yeah.
Of all of this.
Yep.
And then my pressing need to find my needs met. You know, it's like I've got a me is what I'm hearing in this. Yeah. And when you say that, you know, maturing in Christ is about loss, I didn't hear a bunch of resounding yippees all over the world here. That's an interesting concept. Most people don't see that. And I hear you talking about that in terms of a freeing sense of release.
Yeah, I think we try to work so hard on what we can gain, what I can build up in my own life and how people see me as someone of worth or of value and so forth. And we do this in such subtle ways. I remember attending a church for a while where the pastor controlled the congregation by starting the service with about 15 minutes of how wonderful you are. He would talk, you know, we want to...
I don't know that course.
We want to thank so-and-so for sweeping up after this. We like to thank Mrs. So-and-so for cleaning up the patio, and just went on and on and on. And here again, it was this sort of control of making feel good, the need to be recognized and to be important. And we couldn't get along without you guys unless you, you know, did all of this. And it's just so sad that our institution of what once was is no longer that.
And mostly it's very, very subtle. But mm-hmm. A little over a year and a half ago now, I was in Iowa, met a gal, group of folks coming over from a thing, and one gal looked particularly just weighted down, just heavy. And at one point in our discussion about things that we're kind of talking about here, she said, Wayne, can I ask you a question? Are you telling me that I will not go to hell if I don't vacuum the church on Friday afternoon? And she was dead serious. She'd been a believer only a few months, and the pastor had told her that it was her ministry to vacuum the church on Friday, and that's how she earned her salvation. Now,
no manipulation in that.
It's sad. She was taken with it. She was absolutely convinced it was true. She was greatly liberated that day. I'm telling you what, just to watch her countenance change from when she walked in to when she walked out, realizing that this God is not about manipulating us. This God is about crawling into our lives with a relationship of love that does, I think the other half of this thing, what disconnects us from our selfishness. It's not me waking up today saying, I'm not going to be selfish and I'm going to stop controlling people, because we're just not that bright nor that talented.
No, I mean, I think that the words control, manipulate, I would have to think that so many people that are caught in that, they're right now not resonating with that's true.
Right.
I think a subtle thing that you guys brought out in the book and throughout the whole kind of narrative story that develops is that there's this approval game going on that kind of pollutes everything. It is our need and our desire to be validated, to be affirmed, to somehow, you know, find my sense of worth. And that so oftentimes, at least in religious circles, we're using that institution and my servicing of that as a means of getting that sense of approval. Like, I'm a good Christian if, and fill in the blank, depending on however that's defined. That's a lot of what I think people are struggling for. And that's a real trap, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it really is. I think most of us grew up with the idea of conditional love. You know, if you really love me, you'll clean your room, or if you really want to prove your love to me, and so on and so forth. And that's really a threat. And so we grew up with the notion that, you know, if we're really going to be accepted by others, we have to do this, we have to do that, and so forth. And you carry that over into church. How many times have we heard the sermon, you know, if you really call yourself a Christian, you know, you will do this, you will do that, you will be here, you will go there, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the church has played right into that false sense of need and security.
It has. I think, on the one hand, I think affirmation is an incredibly godly tool. Jesus gets it from his Father, the Son in whom I'm well pleased. I think there's a lot in Scripture that some of this that we have wanting to be affirmed is a godly thing. But then when you take that same godly thing and you use it to manipulate people, you affirm them so you get more out of what you want from them. And you wire people. I think a lot of Jake's wiring, and so you don't want to go to church anymore, is all about his desire for approval. Even from a very young age in the little painted chairs in Sunday school to growing up, he's learned that religion is about earning people's approval and earning God's approval. And it wears him out. And when God begins to really lead him And people around him can't affirm the choices he's making and the places where obedience is leading him. And I think any of us been on this journey, you know what that is about. You know what it's like to have your family and your friends just tell you you're nuts, you're going the wrong way, you got to get back in the religious establishment and meet the conformity issues of that thing. The whole sense of losing people's approval is huge because religion succeeds. Because it wires us to other people saying, ah, yeah, you're here Sunday, you're a good person. You're not here, you're a bad person. Because that gets wired in us, the only way that I think that sorts out in us, the way we displace all this stuff is we have a relationship with God that is so real and life transforming that if I get affirmations from others about what God's doing to me, that's a great thing. If I don't get it, I'm not affected by the not getting it. I don't need the approval. Paul's language to the Galatians, if I needed men's approval, I wouldn't be a bondservant of Jesus Christ. You can't live in this kingdom taking your cues from whether other people like what you're choosing to do or not, particularly as you follow him, because a lot of people won't understand it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I'd ever really seen this with the kind of clarity that I think you guys bring out, but this, like, the fallenness that has permeated our institutions. You look at a fair amount of the church and what it's degenerated to is, you kind of brought it out as a shame management system. And so talk a little more about that. I mean, again, that's another thing. I would never have perceived it as such as managing shame. But that's a lot of what's underpinning the book, is that when you finally are able to get out from underneath that, it's a whole brave new world. Well, what's going on there?
It is. I got a friend in Australia that compares it like to being fish in an aquarium versus getting that fish out of the aquarium and throwing him in the ocean. And the difference between you live in this environment, you think that's all there is. And then when you find yourself outside of it, you really see how limited it was. I think shame is the predominant bondage of the fall. It's not even just sin. Sin is not what made Adam and Eve hide from God in the garden. It was their sense of shame about their sin, that somehow we're damaged goods. He's unsafe to be with. Whenever you see Jesus approaching people, woman at the well, Zacchaeus the crook, woman caught in adultery, Jesus is not adding to people's sense of shame, even in their failures. He's lifting shame off of them. You have a father who loves you more. You have a kingdom that you can become involved in, repent, turn, and embrace this new reality. He didn't come to manage people's shame. Religion is great at doing it. It can make you feel guilty for doing anything or not doing what it wants you to do. Shame is the way that we manipulate people. Embarrassing people with guilt is one of those ways of doing it. Affirming them for doing what we want is another way of doing it. It's the same. It's two sides of the same coin.
So, because I don't think shame is part of everyone's, you know, normal everyday vocabulary, talk a little more about that word from a little bit. What is shame?
Well, shame is when you're made to feel guilty.
But doesn't real sin also produce real guilt?
Oh, sure.
So where? What's the shame thing? Because you're I mean, the reason I'm asking is because I think you're talking about something that is so fantastically liberating. But again, it's one of those words that I don't think most of us have much of a real intimate connection to. I don't sit there going, oh, my shame. I got to manage my shame. It's there and I'm getting it. But I just want you to use a little more language that touches people.
And we see it in all kinds of behaviors. People who are boasting, saying how great they are and how much they do for God, that's a shame-based behavior. People who have this inferiority complex, you know, whatever. I don't think sin...
I'm not feeling – when shame is there, I'm not feeling secure in who I am. I'm not I don't have that sense of being approved of by God. Is it that thing that sort of distances me from that place of rest?
I think so. It's the expectations we put on ourselves that somehow we didn't live up to them. I remember when I left the parish ministry and went into other work, the hardest thing for me was to feel that I have somehow failed not only the expectations of family but in friends, but the expectations of God. And I went through a real period that the most difficult thing I ever had to do was to come to the conclusion that God really did love me. And that was hard because all my life I have been, you know, in this whole production system. God will love me when I produce, and he won't love me if I don't produce. And here I wasn't there. And it was, you know, I knew this theologically. I knew it rationally, but experimentally, getting right down into my heart, You know, God surely can't accept me because I'm not doing what I was called to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So how did that finally click? Because I think a lot of people live there. It's like if you would say, you know that God loves you, your average person sitting in a church someplace will go, oh, of course.
Yeah, we sing about it all the time.
Yeah. But I find there are really very few people I know that are just liberatingly secure in that.
I like what Brennan Manning wrote in the book called Abba's Child. He said, so many of us wake up every morning trying to be loved by God instead of waking up every morning as the beloved of God. And I think what we're talking about here is not, have I got stuff in my life that if God wanted me to feel guilty, have I got great reasons to feel guilty? Could I have that for the rest of my life for things I've done? Absolutely. But the cross was about, the thing Jesus hated most about the cross, if you remember, was he endured the cross despising the shame. So we're back to the same word.
Wow.
What Jesus wanted to liberate in the cross was that as we could come to God, broken as we might be, still as unput together as we are, that God is the safest place for us to be. In a religious context, we're always trying to earn that place. The more righteous I can be, the more relationship with God I can have. In the new covenant, it's no, the more relationship with God you have, the more righteous he'll make you to be. We take that language, Jesus saying, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Now, in the religious context, that means if you love me, you'll keep those commandments. So you prove the loving by the keeping. But if you look in the context of that upper room discourse, what Jesus is saying is, if you get the loving right, the keeping takes care of itself.
Wow.
What he's saying is, if you love me, yeah, you'll keep the commandments. That'll just happen. What displaces all of that sin, shame, performance, approval, need, guilt in our lives is to connect with God in such a way that I know today he loves me at my most broken. And if I'll let him love me, he can rebuild me from the core of my life, make me different. I can't do that if I've got things pushing me away from him, feeling unworthy. But that which now by the Spirit of God draws me to him as the safest place to be at my most broken, that's where God gets to affect change in us.
So it sounds like shame is sort of like the seedbed of where I get rejected, my sense of rejection, where
yep.
and with that being removed by the cross and what Jesus was excited about removing would open up my ability to sort of emotionally feel that sense of acceptance. Mm-hmm. That isn't an issue of performance. I mean,
exactly.
That's what I'm hearing.
It disconnects acceptance from performance.
Wow.
So that we do have God's affection, maybe even a better word than acceptance. We do have God's affection. Yeah, is there things God sees about my life that aren't right today? Absolutely. I'm not there yet. I'd love to be there. But the only hope I have of displacing my selfishness, control, manipulation, shame, all the words we've been talking about today, the only hope I have of displacing those is knowing him in such a way that he wins me. He wins my affection, and my love and my trust in him is greater than my desire to control my own well-being.
Wow. That actually is good news.
Now, that would be good news.
That would be good news. I wonder why that's not preached all that often. I'm serious. That's a genuine question. I don't know if either of you have an answer for that. But
well, look at what we just talked about. If you preach that, you're giving up control. And the scary thing is when you free people to walk with Jesus, then you can't control them or their money. They don't become cogs in your plans and structure. You free them to live as free people in the life of Christ. And I think we're scared of that. I think success of institution means we continue to breed a dependency on us. And the gift of the new covenant is we breed a dependency on every life and the King. Have at Jesus, your older brother and the Father he's brought us to. When you teach people to be free to do that, then they won't follow all those religious little hula hoops we throw around for people to follow.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people, I mean, most of the pastors I know, I mean, they are wonderful people and they're well-intentioned. They begin in that place. And yet, as soon as it seems like there's a measure of a something that they've created, and they would say God is building.
Yeah, and they see it as building the kingdom.
Yeah.
Most people don't think I'm trying to put my institution together.
It's like there's
I'm really doing something significant for God.
Yeah, there's a successful gathering. There's a certain amount of – there's a threshold that
Absolutely.
They come to. And then all of a sudden it's like something warps unintentionally where all of a sudden it's like the needs of the institution, the needs of the what they've built become more important than the individual that's in front of them that may or may not be have help to that. And a lot of what the narrative in your guys' book that brings out is, man, those come into real conflict. And what do you do with that? You know, on either side, whether you're an attender or whether you're one of the performers up front, the challenge of how you relate to that institution and what it has created, wow, I mean.
Yeah, and I think one of the side things in this book that we didn't really, at least I don't think I consciously intended when we got started, and we talked about it a little bit earlier this morning, I think the whole Jake-John relationship becomes a great example of what real discipleship really is. When you look at the changes that happen in Jake's life, because just the conversations, John, he's asking him questions. He's helping him see things he hasn't seen before. And the dramatic changes come in Jake's life and his ability to perceive his world through God's eyes instead of his need to control it and his need to earn other people's approval. I think it's as sweet as discipleship gets. I know it's a thing about Dave's life that has influenced me the most. It's not even his gifts in ministry, his ability to speak or those things. It's been a relationship with a brother that's helped me see things I hadn't seen before. And it's been liberating for me in so many ways.
This may be a really hard question to kind of just give a simple answer to, but if you were to summarize the book, the Jake Colson book, and a single sentence or a thought, what is this about?
It's about seeing God who he really is. It's about freedom in God. It's being able to relax from all of the emotional and the religious stress that people have. I sent a copy of the book to an old friend of mine who was a pastor years ago that I met. It's been about 30 years ago. And he's retired now too. And sent him a copy of the book. And he wrote back 3 days later and he said, you know, thank you. He said, I wish I would have had this years ago. Can you send me 15 copies to give to some of my friends and some of the pastors that I know as well? And I think, you know, I just sat there and, you know, like Wayne gets these and kind of, and you just say, you know, thank you, Lord, for, you know, the opportunity just to free some people and understand, you know, who God really is. When you look at, you know, the whole concept of what Jesus did, he was always pointing to the love of the Father. You know, whether he was just talking about the lilies of the field or the birds of the air, was always that one concept. You know, you can trust God. You can trust God. You don't have to maneuver him, manipulate him, put him in a box, if you will. You can just allow him to be the God he wants to be. And if that book just helps, you know, a few people along the way see that principle, that's basically what I was thinking about. I think Wayne was too.
Yeah, I mean, if it didn't do any more than what it's already done for some people, it was well worth all we've done to write it and live this story. I mean, we joke about it taking 4 years, but quite honestly, when we began this book, we did not know where we would end. And some of those lessons we had yet to live from when we started out, this book became very different at the end than I think either one of us thought it would be starting out. So even though we were delayed by a lot of things, in the end, I look back and say, I'm sorry for the people we tortured by taking it that long to get it on. But I am amazed by the letters we get, people just saying, this has changed the whole way I think about God and the way I live in the world. And so it is about someone moving from the bondage of religion to the reality of a relationship with God that's transforming. And that, to me, is the heart of the gospel.
Yeah, as someone who has enjoyed being a reader of the book, I felt like so much of my own story was, I felt like I was reading a little bit of my imposed autobiography as because, you know, this happens to so many people. It's like you serve and you do what you can to be pleasing to the Lord, and somewhere in the course of that journey, you just can't escape the ache of the emptiness that doesn't work.
Yep.
And so there's a universal appeal in what you guys have touched on is that, you know, I think just about anybody who's ever tried to be pleasing to God is going to find some resonance in these pages because they're going like, yeah, it didn't really work. And yet the great news of this gospel is that he does love us, and that isn't some ethereal, mystical, I can't know for myself concept. It's It's supposed to be tangible and life-altering.
Yeah, I think life-altering is the key. It's not some kind of cheap grace that you just get to go on and live however you want because God just loves us all. It's not that, because it's that love that transforms us and has. I know when I finished this book, I felt bad no longer being able to write for John. I was a better guy when I spent afternoons thinking the things through that we put into John's mouth. And I've had people write me say, you guys are going to do a sequel, aren't you? Because we want to read more John stuff. And I would say, you know what? What we hope to put in John was what Jesus wants to be to all of us. And so whatever passion, I know people say, I'd like to meet John. Can you send him by? I'm saying, you already have him. But if we could engage Jesus in a way, take all that passion that John stirred up in us and put it on him, and that's the life he wants to take us on, I think.
It's interesting. I won't ruin it for everybody, but there is this question throughout the whole book, you know, who really is John?
Yep.
And it's interesting how you kind of, in the last few pages, you kind of allude to the fact that all of a sudden it was clear to you who he was. But I sat there going like, man, I think if there's a few people who's looking like, well, who was he? Who was he? And I think there's a beauty there.
I think
there's a beauty there.
Because it's absolutely clear, but I do get those emails.
I know that.
I read it. I don't know.
No, but I think what's so beautiful is I appreciated the tenor with which both of you wrote, because I didn't feel like I was getting preached to. I didn't think this was a bunch of like mini sermons all connected through a narrative. There was a lot of teaching in there, and I really devoured it. I mean, I do think it's more hand grenades blowing up preconceived notions than it is statements that tell you what to think.
Well, let's look at it as keys and handcuffs rather than...
Well, what you did is you unlocked stuff, and you helped pose, I think, a lot of questions that maybe people haven't really formulated, like, oh, yeah, that's what I'm dealing with. But that's what was really, I think, cathartic for me as I read this, going like, yeah, this is some of that journey that I'm on. And I could see where my life was paralyzed, different aspects of what was going on there. And it just, I want to thank both of you guys for a labor of love that, 4 years, my gosh, I think you distilled lessons you've learned probably over your lifetime in this thing.
For sure. And I think with Dave too. So, yeah.
Yeah. To really understand and appreciate the book, I think you have to come to the conclusion that Wayne and I did before we started writing it. That what we were doing, what we were saying, what we were teaching just did not work. It just didn't work. People weren't experiencing, we weren't experiencing in our personal lives this whole thing that we just toss off so easily, the love of God. Well, what does that finally mean? Is that what it is? Doing stuff or not doing stuff, going to meetings, teaching classes, and so forth. And if someone, really feels that what they're doing is working, then they won't like the book. They won't accept it. They won't understand it. But you have to ask yourself the question, is what I am doing today, is it bringing me closer to God?
Yeah, it's about disillusioned people, getting their illusions just so that they can discover something more real. Dave, thanks for coming down today. We want him to come down and expose him to some of y'all and get to meet a good, good friend of mine and brother. And we thought the book gave us a good excuse to do that. So, Dave, thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. It's been just a joy to be with you guys, and I wish you well on some of the new projects you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, those.
Yeah. So just before we leave, where did the whole idea of John and his, this being the Apostle John possibly still being alive, where did that idea come from? Because I found that really intriguing.
That's been a story I've lived with for, almost 40-some-odd years. A man actually came to our home when I was a kid. I was 12 or 13. He was talking to my parents. He was telling about that he'd been in a park in Los Angeles. He had heard a guy talking about Jesus with a small group of people. He kind of merged into the group, listened. He was so struck by the intimacy with which this man spoke about Jesus that he thought, man, I wonder. And he was there for some time, but finally thought, man, I wonder. This is just like who I imagined the Apostle John to be. And that guy kind of paused and gave him a goofy kind of look and smile. And so it sent chills down his heart. I was like, what is that about? So he did pursue the guy when he got done speaking, and he kind of pushed his way through the crowd to get to him as John kind of, this guy, whoever he was, turned around this corner of this little building in the park. By the time he got around that corner, the guy was gone. So he was telling my parents this, and it was kind of gave us the heebie-jeebies about, you know, was this an angel? Is John? Could John really be here? In fact, Jesus told Peter, what if I let John live till I come again? What is that to you? Definitely make him an old critter. So that's been something that's played in my mind for a long time, and I thought, what a fun thing to bring into a story. It opens the possibility. You don't know what God's doing in the world.
That was just it was fun to read that. I just want to encourage folks, go out and get a copy of the book and just devour it. Enjoy reading it because it's going to have an absolutely freeing effect on your life.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your questions or feedback by email or at our blog at thegodjourney.com. Or you can call 24 hours a day to our comment line at 805-626-4212.